It's time for Mac Break Weekly. We have the full panel assembled. Renee Ritchie from iMore, Alex Lindsay from the Pixel Corps, and from WGBH in Boston, Mr. Andy Inatko. We're going to talk about, of course, the Mac Mini and the Apple MacBook Air, but we most of all will talk about the iPad Pro. Is it too much horsepower for a little old me? It's all coming up next on and Mac on a very special big Mac Break Weekly. Stay tuned. You'll see what I mean in a little bit. It's all going to make sense.
Netcasts you love
from people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Mac Break Weekly, episode 636, recorded Tuesday, November 13th, 2018. Like a Porsche in Canada. Mac Break Weekly is brought to you by LastPass. Secure every password-protected entry point to your business. Join over 43,000 businesses and start managing and securing your company's passwords today. Learn more at lastpass.com/twit. And by privacy.com. Stop using the same credit card number everywhere. Use Privacy Virtual Cards and get a $5 credit off your first purchase. Learn more and sign up in under a minute with your debit or checking account at privacy.com/MacBreak. And by Slide Belts by Brig Taylor. High-quality, comfortable ratchet belts that are easy to adjust. If you want a better belt, go to slidebelts.com/twit and use the code TWIT for 20% off. It's time for Mac Break Weekly, the show where we cover the latest news from Apple with Renee Ritchie at iMore.com and the Vector Podcast. Hi, Renee.
Hey, Leo. It's snowing outside, but it's nice and warm in here with all of you.
How cozy. I like it when it snows outside, as long as you're inside.
Cozy. Yeah, totally.
Also, Andy Inatko from WGBH in Boston, Boston Public Radio. It's probably snowing where you are, too, I would guess.
No, but this is apparently the weather is having its annual leaves on the trees clearance sale. Very, very fierce wind, and it's really, really ambitiously trying to clear all of the trees.
Get all ready. Leaves must go.
The incoming inventory of snow is coming. We must make room for it.
It's great to have you. And also from the nation's capital or Toronto. Actually, that's Seattle, isn't it? That's not the CN Tower. That's the Sky Needle. Alex Lindsay, pixelcore.com. Hello, Alex.
Hello, hello.
Good to see you.
Good to be
How
here.
Many of you got new Macs, iPads, anything?
I'm still holding out. I'm letting them ship out that first section, and then once they kind of move through them, then I'll look at buying them after they say, "Oops, sorry, we needed to do one more thing."
Leo and I won't beta test for you, Alex. We'll take all the beta testing.
I'm letting you guys do it.
I have to say, if you could eliminate, take out of your mind any consideration about money, because this is going to add up, I would absolutely recommend getting the new 12.9-inch iPad Pro plus pencil plus keyboard. I would absolutely recommend getting a MacBook Air, but not if it's your only computer. And the Mac Mini is maybe your desktop with a 5K monitor. All of those are, for what that niche that they fill, they're really great.
Yeah, I was looking really hard at the Mac Mini a couple nights ago. There might be a Mac Mini in my future near the end of the year.
I think it's, I mean, look, it doesn't have the Xeon Pro chips, but very few people need that kind of horsepower or multiple processors. The desktop chips in the Mac Mini, plus the amazing connectivity options it offers, mean it's, I think, a really good desktop machine. Honestly.
Yeah. And the A10 inside it is accelerating all the video stuff, so it gives you a little edge over what the Intel silicon by itself can do, which is really nice.
Yeah. Above all, it looks like it's kitted out to last you at least 4, 5, or 6 years. My worry was that the next update to the Mac Mini was going to be incremental by nature and really wasn't going to be worth investing a whole $1,000 in a whole new box just to get new silicon or maybe like one or two extra ports. This really does look like you could spend $1,500 to max it out and trust that you're going to get a good lifetime product out of it.
You're probably going to want, for some of you anyway, an eGPU, but that actually isn't a bad way to go either. In fact, a lot of people are a little perturbed because Apple has announced that they're going to start putting the Radeon Vega inside the MacBook Pros, and people who bought their MacBook Pro 6 months ago are going, wait a minute, I want that. But the eGPU
if they didn't do it,
is
like, why aren't they updating?
Yeah, I know. You can't win. The eGPU is a pretty for the Mac Mini a pretty good choice. You know, the motherboard, the Intel graphics are nothing to write home about. But for many of us, that doesn't matter. I have to say, by the way, just my anecdotal story about the MacBook Air, because a lot of people complained about the Y chip in there, and it's fast enough. It's more than fast enough. Yep. I'm happy with it. In fact, I've kind of put aside my i9 MacBook Pro because the Air is so much more portable and light, and it does it's good enough. It's fast enough. Let's put it that way. I don't feel like it's sluggish, and it's like coming home again to use.
Have to render Final Cut Pro at events fast, I would still be using. Yeah. I would be using that MacBook Air.
You know who you are. If you're doing that, you need a MacBook Pro.
Yeah.
But the MacBook Air for most people is a great, very portable, beautiful. I wish the keyboard were not the butterfly, but it's not as bad as the original butterfly. And it's just great. And no touch bar, which makes me happy, but touch ID, which makes me happy. It's a really nice little laptop. I'm very happy with it.
It's the Goldilocks computer. Almost literally. It's
literally
right in the middle of
I got the gold.
It just fits so well. Yeah. Oh, it looks so good, that new gold.
The gold is really pretty. All right. We've talked about this. And Renee, you had these all last week. It's just that I got mine this week. And, Thursday, I guess. I don't remember what day.
Well, people are still asking Wednesday. About them. Like every day, there's just questions and questions and questions because other people are waiting. They're like Alex and Andy. They're waiting to see what the beta testers are going to think.
Yeah. I'm pretty happy with it. I think all the news really, though, is about the iPad Pros. You know, you already know what the Mac Mini is. You already know what the MacBook Air is. They're just updated versions of existing products, right? There's a T2 chip in there. In fact, one of the things we're learning is that Apple may use the T2 to block some third-party repairs of new Macs. That's probably similar to when you replace the screen and the Touch ID on an old iPhone. They say, well, the secure enclave has been breached. And so as a result, we can't certify those repairs and make it secure again. What's your sense of, Renee, what Apple is saying? Does it mean it won't work at all? It'll brick it or what?
No, so my understanding is that they've set it up in such a way that it's, you know, the security is really bound to a lot of the components. They're hardwired directly in. One of the things with the MacBook Air specifically is that it doesn't have a touch bar. On previous Mac Pros, the touch bar and Touch ID were literally hardwired together so that if you saw a price on Safari, that price would be on the touch bar and you knew there was no spoofing man in the middle, nothing going on to sort of cheat you. And because that doesn't exist on the MacBook Air, they've hardened the connection between the Mac between the actual Mac display and Touch ID, and that will work. But if at any point that the secure enclave cannot verify that connection, including if you do a certain third-party repairs that break the hardware pairing, my understanding is that all that happens is it will refuse to authenticate Touch ID on the machine because it now can be spoofed, and you'll have to use an iOS device to do it like you would on a Mac that doesn't have the Touch ID sensor.
So T2 taketh and giveth away.
Yes.
It giveth in the sense that it is, for instance, when you close the laptop lid, now we know that the T2 blocks the microphone. There's a lot of security in there, but there's some question about whether you'll be able to install unsigned operating systems like Linux on a Macintosh.
So I asked about that, and you absolutely can, but again, it will... You have to go in, you have to boot into recovery mode, you have to go into the system integrity protection settings, you have to turn it down to nothing. Like you have three levels of settings, almost like Gatekeeper, where you have full security, partial security, and nothing. You turn it to nothing, then you can run any operating system you want. But again, at that point, Touch ID can no longer verify that it's a secure connection to the sensor, so you'll have to, everything else works, you'll just have to use an iOS device to authenticate Apple Pay like you would on a device that doesn't have Touch ID.
That's not the end of the world. That's fairly common in the Linux world that things like that don't work. Kyle Weens of iFixit, who's, by the way, going to be on Triangulation on Friday, says...
Oh, awesome.
He told The Verge the T2 is a guillotine that Apple is holding over product owners. Apparently, when you get a repair, the T2 chip now checks for the parts during a post-repair reboot, We're not Apple confirmed that this is true, but we don't not sure how they're going to react, right? If it says, well, those are third party parts, right?
Yeah, I'm not buying the whole Apple's trying to stop people from repairing their machines. I mean, it may be a side effect, but I don't think it's the main issue. Yeah. I think that Apple is moving more and more into health and financial services, and as a result, and I think they're going to continue to move that way. And I think that our privacy and security are going to become more and more of an issue as we keep going forward. And as a result, Apple is putting hardware devices in. And it makes sense that if someone's tampering with the computer, you don't want it to.
Well, but there's tampering and there's repairs.
I understand. But the thing is they're not going to be able to tell the difference between the two. And if you're not from that area, I just don't think they're more concerned about the security than they are about, because of larger business things, than, and specifically related, again, I think, towards, security related as it relates to health and financial services, which are going to become a big part of what they're doing, I think.
Right.
So I think that they're mostly interested in security, and one of the casualties of that is being able to repair it.
Here's what the Apple repair manual says. For Macs with the Apple T2 chip, the repair process is not complete for certain part replacements until the AST2 system configuration suite has been run. And that, of course, checks with the T2. Failure to perform this step will result in an inoperative system and an incomplete repair. What they don't say is what parts. And I think that will be the determinant of whether you're right or wrong, Alex, is if they say, well, look, any part concerned with security. Yeah, I'd have to say that's reasonable. Go ahead, Andy. I'm sorry.
No, I was just going to say that, Alex is right. It's easy to ascribe to malice on Apple's part what is actually just simply collateral damage from what they think is a higher priority. For them, security is the highest priority of all. If it makes this device harder to fix, that's not a problem that's on their radar, but the security and the integrity of the entire system is on their radar. We should definitely note that this gives them an ability that they didn't have before, but it would take a really serious change in philosophy for Apple to simply decide to make an item unreparable simply to kill other people's fun and or opportunities, or just to make it less reparable to begin with. Every time they screw a consumer over, like, again, removing a headphone jack, it's not because they did that for fun. It's because there was a technical problem that they were not in the mood to try to solve, because they felt as though having a much, much thinner device or having a display that goes all the way to the edge of the bezel was more important to them than including this thing. So reparability is the second or third tier sort of thing for them. And making sure that the integrity of the entire system is maintained even when parts get swapped out is definitely the first priority for them.
So you're right. We cannot know Apple's intent in any of this. And so we're at this point speculating on Apple's intent. Let's not. We don't know what Apple's intent is. What we can say is the upshot of it is that you don't have, and again, we don't know which part changes will or will not be affected by this, but there will be at least some parts that no third party can repair, that only an ASP, an Apple-approved service bureau, or Apple itself can repair, because only they can run the appropriate software. This is exactly what John Deere says about its tractors. I'm willing to stipulate that Apple's doing this on the side of the angels. But what I'm saying is that it does, in fact, impact your right to repair.
Well, it also makes it less attractive to hobbyists, and I think they know that. Like, when they went out of their way to say that the third party the RAM could be changed in the Mac Mini, but they suggested strongly that unless you were like an iFixit class whiz, that you take it into Apple to have it done, because so they're specifically for the Mac Mini. I mean, they understand that that's a different market, and hobbyists and people who do want to mess around with their computers are much more likely to buy it. For things like laptops that have those sorts of security chips, they're not aiming for hobbyists anymore. They think their market is decidedly mainstream, and people who prefer iPads but still need a Mac, and they're catering for those. But it is fair to say that they're less they should be less attractive to hobbyists, and maybe hobbyists should go elsewhere. And if Apple sees that as a big part of their market atrophying, maybe they'll change and address it.
Yeah, but they, just a footnote to that, there's a difference between hobbyists and simply getting value for your system. You don't know what's going to happen to your laptop or your Mac Mini or whatever after 3 or 4 years. And it really is a kick in the pants when you're told that, well, there's a $130 memory module that has gone bad, or your SSD. I know that this is the third time in 5 years you've had to totally reformat it because it kept spitting out bad blocks. And that would be maybe a $200 part, but we've not given you the ability to replace that, and so we're going to have to ask you for $1,000 for a brand new logic board, or it's probably a good time for you to replace the machine. That's a kick in the pants when you look at alternatives and think that, well, if I if I'd bought an Intel Nook, I wouldn't have had a Macintosh, but I would have had a completely up and back running machine for $130 instead of looking at, God, why am I have to spend $800 to $1,000 to replace an entire thing just because a simple $100 component was not meant to be replaced? Well, so it's definitely a factor, but it's part of the larger calculus.
Yeah, I'm sure there's other reasons, but I've had that experience directly a long time ago. The power connector on one of my PowerBooks, that's how long time ago it was a PowerBook, broke. I took it to Apple. They said, yeah, we have to replace the logic board. That'll be $1,500. Fortunately, there still was Mac Adam, Tom Santos's wonderful Macintosh store with real repair people. And the guy said, yeah, no, I could just resolder that on the motherboard. And they fixed it for $10 and it was fine. Those days are long gone. Frankly, repairability is not a prime feature in any Apple device or many consumer electronics devices.
There are a lot of really talented cowboys out there and cowgirls out there. And so I'd much rather make it available to see if there's people who can fix things. If you want to if you want to upgrade the storage RAM on an iPhone, it is possible to do that. You can simply buy the right tool. You can remove the RAM, reflow the solder, put in new RAM. And yes, that is well beyond even a hobbyist. But the idea of when you're Googling for answers to my $2,300 MacBook Pro that I bought 3 or 4 years ago can't be fixed for less than $1,200 as far as Apple is concerned. And then you Google and you see, well, someone is willing to it can swap me out my motherboard reflow and replace the SSD here for something less than $400. If I want to take that risk, we have the principle that if I own this MacBook, I can actually do what I want with it, including throw it in a mulcher or trust some cowboy or cowgirl to try to fix it for me. So I'm hoping that we will see the same opportunities for people to find a fix for a problem, because there are a lot of people for whom that was quite a stretch to spend $1,200 even on a MacBook Air. And if they can keep it going, or if they can hand it down to a kid who's going off to school who needs a laptop, instead of having to find another $1,000 that they don't have to give to that kid, that is a big, big win. So I don't think Apple would shut that door capriciously, but I'm very much in favor of people being free to find those kind of cowboy frontier solutions on their own.
The Verge does make the point that you tend to keep Macs around a lot longer than you do phones, so it's more of an issue. And Weens said something kind of interesting. If Apple does this, it will dramatically increase the likelihood that right-to-repair legislation passes and forces them to reverse the course. I doubt Apple considers the political calculus, but politically this might be an impolitic thing to do.
Well, it's not just that, but it's also the EU, which is being a lot more strict about such like that. I would doubt that Apple would do something that they couldn't reverse. They wouldn't lock something into hardware that they couldn't reverse if they had to, because of the political situation changing both here and abroad.
Yeah, I think you actually nailed it. The right thing to do is to say, well, as they have with Linux, it's your device. You can do anything you want with it, but just understand it won't be secure anymore.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's why Renee's explanation is so valuable. That to me is the right thing to do, to say that if you're willing to go, here is a free firmware tool that will basically say that you will have the security of essentially a 2004 MacBook, which is none, but you will be able to do what you want with it. But just realize that all this cool stuff that is not happening to you because you're running a modern Mac, you are on the other side of that great wall right now. And the orcs and the zombies are sharpening their knives for you.
Well, and I'm not clear that, I mean, we've talked about it a long time here, but I'm not sure that the average person, I mean, there's a lot, Mac, I mean, iFixit thinks it's important, but I don't know if the average person really thinks much about it.
I think right to repair is important.
Yeah,
I'll stand up for right to repair.
I'm not saying that it's not important or important, but I think the average user, you know, a lot of people. I mean, if you're smart, you buy.
I disagree. I think people, you know, there's a risk business in replacing iPhone screens, for instance.
Yeah, exactly.
I think real people like my kids believe they should be able to take it to a store and get the screen fixed if it breaks.
They do once it breaks, yeah.
and I wouldn't, I guess I wouldn't buy a piece of electronics that I thought was important that I didn't put Apple Care on, you know, from Apple, you know, I don't have to think about it.
Well,
you know, like it's
that's a profit center
that
for Apple.
The thing is that doesn't help you when you're in trouble. I'm in that situation right now. I've got it's not as though I can't on this MacBook Pro of mine. It's not as though I can't reformat it and get back to a working SSD. But the thing is, I've already reformatted a couple times. They're just bad blocks that keep popping up, and I would much rather replace it. And now I'm looking at more and more interesting ways of fixing it. And fortunately, because I've got perhaps the 2015 MacBook Pro was the very last MacBook Pro where the SSD wasn't actually soldered in. It's actually on some sort of a board. Apple looks like they didn't use something quite standard. So it's not as though you can just go onto eBay and get it replaced, but at least there's some solution available to you. This is something that I wasn't looking forward to 3 years ago. And I'm not sure I would have been paying Apple Care year after year after year. Like I said, you're in the position where you're saying this is a two. If this was any other laptop, if this had been my ThinkPad, this would have been like a $130 thing. I just buy something online at OWC or whatever. I undo some screws. I slip the other one out. I put the new one in. I'm done. But this is a thing, and I don't want to have to spend $2,000 or even $1,200 because this is just a this is just an SSD I need to fix, man. So I really hope that the door remains open for people to find ways to fix their own things. If they believe in recycling, they certainly should believe in people being able to keep an old beater running. It's very good for the environment. It keeps out of the hands of kids and keeps in the hands of the second owner, the third owner on Craigslist or eBay, who can now afford for $400 the 2005 model that used to cost $3,000, but at least they've got a working laptop. It's a very, very positive thing to make sure these things stay out in circulation. And the Macs, they build Macs to last. They build iPads to last. May as well keep them running while they're lasting.
We're going to take a break. I think I still have three or four cheese graters that are
still running. And they're repairable. Highly repairable.
But I haven't needed to. Right.
I'm using one as an end table right now.
Yeah.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah. I mean, I think for the environment alone, the lack of repairability on these newer devices is a little shameful. And it is possible to do it. I look at Lenovo's. You can still swap in anything on a Lenovo.
And we should say that's not limited to Apple. A lot of manufacturers.
Oh, absolutely.
It's much less expensive to manufacture when you glue things together and stuff like that. It's just that as we keep saying with Apple, they're the only company making MacBooks. They're the only company making iPads. So if they don't make any, that means there's absolutely nowhere in the world that makes an easy to repair MacBook. Right. So you don't have that option someplace.
Right.
And I think
Go ahead, Renee.
No, I was just going to say, I think, like I've said before, I think there's a lot of choices that can happen here. One is that you can make a MacBook much more repairable. The other is that you can make it absolutely inexpensive and available to get what you consider to be quality parts. If you've got any issue like, oh, people are going to put in bad batteries and burn down their houses, and we don't want that to happen, so we want you to have certified parts, then, and I think Apple has started doing this, they've increased the iPhone repair program going back, I think, several additional years lately, then just it's incumbent upon anything you take away from me, it is now incumbent upon you to totally support and provide.
Yeah, you better do it. Yes. Yeah, at a reasonable or a fair price.
Yeah, or at cost or something. Yeah, totally.
Yeah, yep. No, that's fair. Let's take a break. I do want to talk about the iPad Pro. Lots of stuff to say about this very interesting device. But first, a word from LastPass. You know, I set up a bunch of new computers this week, and practically the very first thing I put on all of them is LastPass, because LastPass is my password vault. It makes it easy to install the rest of the software I'm going to put on. LastPass lets you secure every password-protected entry point to your business, too. And this is important. We take this so seriously at Twit. Every employee gets a free LastPass account. That's part of their benefits to being an employee, and we use LastPass Enterprise because, unfortunately, you know, password hygiene is not very good in general. Bad passwords cause about 81% of all breaches, and that means reused passwords, passwords that are easy to guess, passwords that are written on a Post-it note and stuck to the screen of the computer. And I know you've seen all three. You've probably done all three. LastPass makes it easy to create strong passwords with their password generator, unique random passwords. And there's no incentive to make them weak because you don't have to remember them. You don't have to write them down. LastPass keeps track of them for you and even autofills them. iOS 12, that autofill in LastPass is so sweet. It uses Face ID to automatically unlock the vault and paste it in. Does it on Android as well now, too. So that's a nice feature. LastPass also allows us as a business to set policies, for instance, master password requirements. We can do password resets when people forget their master password. We can restrict access as we need to. We also can require multi-factor authentication, which we do. LastPass has its own authenticator app, but you can use any authenticator app. But I like the LastPass one because it doesn't do a six-digit code. It just pops up an approve or deny request on the phone when, for instance, our bookkeeper logs into our QuickBooks account. That means even if her password were compromised, no one else can get in unless they have her phone, too. I can go on and on. It's really a nice, well, there are over 100 policies that you can set as a LastPass Enterprise user. We create shared folders, too, so all the ops people have one shared folder. The business people have another shared folder. That keeps the passwords kind of constrained within an area, but it also means we can give people access to assets without giving them the password at all. The autofill means that they just log in and it's there, which makes it a lot harder for them to steal it or give it away or share it. And we know a lot of employees share passwords too, not just with people in the enterprise, but everywhere. LastPass offers a variety of passwords for no matter what your situation. LastPass Premium for personal use. I've used that for more than 10 years. I upgraded to families for our family because now we can share passwords. Lisa and I can share all the accounts for like the cable company and the power bill and stuff like that. That makes it so easy. When I create a new password that she needs access to, I just put it in that folder. It's automatically shared with her. LastPass Teams for smaller businesses, 50 or fewer employees. And what we use, of course, LastPass Enterprise. It is the best. 43,000 businesses use LastPass for business. 16 million people trust LastPass for their own passwords. It's literally the number one most preferred password manager. And needless to say, your passwords are encrypted only and decrypted only at the device level. So even somebody at LastPass can't get access to them. Only you do. LastPass is awesome. Go to LastPass.com/twit. Set up your account right now. LastPass.com/twit, especially if you have a business. You really need to use LastPass. Trust me. Learn from my experience. Renee Ritchie does, I guess, without Serenity Caldwell around to do your reviews of the pencil. Renee has done
up my game.
He's upped his game. You're a pretty good artist, Renee.
It's misspent youth, Leo.
This is awesome. So the pencil review on iMore.com is done with the Apple Pens. That's recognizably Tim Cook. I just want to say that's pretty good.
That's me getting my meme on.
Oh, that's you.
That's me getting my meme on. You've got your stylus, but you're looking at the new stylus.
So let's talk about the iPad Pro, the pencil, the keyboard, all in one, because it's a whole new thing. First of all, in this review, you're talking about the fact that the means of pairing to the old iPad Pros through the Lightning port obviously no longer work with the new iPad Pros. That means your old pencil will no longer work with the new iPad Pros.
It cannot pair nor charge off, like the old pencil cannot pair nor charge off the new iPad, and the new pencil cannot pair nor charge off the old iPad.
Alas.
So you got to pair new and new and old and old.
So you need to get a new one, $129, but you can get it engraved.
Yes, Leo's pencil.
Yes, actually it says Dream Boy, but there's a long story behind that. Megan says Dream Girl, and there's a whole story. Okay. Anyway. But that's nice because there's no question of whose pencil. And if you're in a multi-iPad family, as I am, or a multi-iPad business, as I am, it's nice to have your name or something identifying on your pencil.
Your Homer Simpson thing is supposed to go in the back of that, Leo. That's how you're supposed to tell it apart.
Oh, yeah.
The little pencil cap.
It won't work with the charger, though. It has to be flush on the charger.
One of my gripes in that video is, like, I love the Apple logo on the pencil. I don't like the word pencil there, especially with the engraving, because it's a little much. It's like Rocket Raccoon. It's a little much.
Yeah. There are a number of people complain about that. It's a nit. It's absolutely a nit.
Yeah.
You no longer have to worry about losing the cap, which is good. There is no cap.
Yes.
It does. Apparently, Megan told me these are interchangeable. The nibs are interchangeable with the old one.
Nib and the core technology in the – so the pencil, all the pressure sensitive technology for the pencil is not in the iPad screen. It's in the pencil. None of that has changed with Pencil 2. So all of that works the same. The tips are the same. The angulation, the pressure, all of that remains the same as the previous one.
It is – I am not a drawer, so I have yet to find a good use for it. But I suppose if you buy an iPad Pro, whichever size you pick, you really ought to get the pencil.
Ben Thompson graphs.
Yeah, that's about as good as I'll get. And the keyboard, right now you can only get an Apple, the new Apple Portfolio keyboard, but I know that Bridge and others are going to do third-party keyboards as well. But the Apple keyboard's pretty good, and I really like the Folio case. It wraps around very nicely. It makes it very portable. This is the 12.9, which is, my opinion, exactly the right size.
It's more lappable. Like that keyboard. Like before, I used to use it in my lap, like even at Apple events, and it was a little bit precarious because it would almost like teeter totter. Right. But now it's really solid and you know, big points in the lappability scale.
And as Apple said, it's about the size of an 8.5 by 11, or I guess for you foreigners, what is it, A1 piece of paper?
I don't know. A3, A4, I forget.
It's standard size. A4, is that what it is? Or somebody else said it's about the size of a magazine, kind of like that. I have to say, I have no quibbles about the hardware at all. It's fantastic.
It's legit fantastic hardware.
It's legit super fast. It's a beautiful screen. All my complaints are, as Nilay Patel and others have said, about the fact that the software just doesn't live up to the hardware.
How so?
This is a laptop priced device that should be reasonably replace your laptop. It is still, in my opinion, an adjunct device. Now, I know, and this is where I mean when I say money should be no object. If you don't think about how much it costs, you should just have an iPhone, an iPad, and an iMac, and a MacBook. Just have them all, and then you have the right tool for the right job. But if you want to make the iPad be your own, and at the price they're charging, it probably most people, this is your only Apple device. It isn't going to do everything you need to do.
I could do, like, I'm not like Federico Vittici level iPad only. I could do that, again, if it wasn't for Final Cut Pro. I know Serenity can edit in iMovie on iPad like an ace. I cannot. So I need, for Photoshop and Final Cut Pro, I still go back to the Mac. But when I travel and I only take my iPad with me, those are really the only things I miss. And
do
I
you totally find it hard to write? Do you find it hard to write on it?
No, I love writing on it. But again, like I'm keyboard agnostic. But I get Nilay and like other people like Steve Troughton Smith, there are certain basic things that it's missing. And I'm not a person who thinks that Apple has to make it a Mac. Like, I think that would be a huge mistake. I'm all for Apple reinterpreting computer paradigms like they did drag and drop and all those things. But they need some way for – right now, if you want to use external storage, for example, you need an app that supports it, which no human should have to deal with old school Unix hierarchies of file systems. But also no human should have to go figure out how to just stick their card or stick their drive in there and have it work, especially because Apple has built – file picker, the same as image picker, and you stick a card in there from a camera, and it just works. So why don't my file just work?
Is iCloud, though, that external thing? Is just by wireless, not by...
It is, but then you've got, like, let's say your stuff is on a card, or you're at a school, and you get a thumb drive or something, and you shouldn't have to go find a Mac and upload the stuff.
That's my point. You can't live on it. And that really is a limitation of iOS. It's not a limitation of the hardware. It's a limitation.
It's not even
of
a
iOS.
Limitation. Yeah, I mean, like, it's not – they have all the stuff. They just have not enabled it in file. I'm guessing, like, they had a bunch of stuff that was supposed to be in iOS 12 that got pushed back so they could do all the performance enhancements, including a new home screen springboard thing. And I'm very much hoping that includes a lot of the stuff that's going to really make this iPad sing. But until then, they're going to have to put up with Nilay for like 6 months, and he's going to be right.
I kind of agree, kind of don't agree, chiefly because I think this can replace your laptop, but only when you accept that most people have a unique method, a unique job that they use their laptop for. For someone like Renee, they need to have their desktop with them in a bag because they are I'm gonna tip the hat to Renee, because Renee is like always capturing 4K video somewhere. He is always either at the same time writing, editing, and publishing and streaming three of those at the same time. And so there can be no compromises. And even if there's only one rare occasion where someone needs to get a file from one of these onto the storage, that's going to be a big issue if you're using your entire office on a laptop. Other people like me, it's more like I need a lightweight device that I can carry with me all day long. It's not going to hurt my shoulder, and it's not going to be for everything I need to do outside the office. And I'm willing to take along a Logitech K11 keyboard for really heavy typing if it means that this iPad will also be my book reader when I'm on the flight, or it will also be a really, really good tablet pencil art thing when I need to when I'm in a place where, believe it or not, I'm not allowed to take pictures anywhere, but I can do sketches, and I'm going to do sketches where I go. So you just can't say that it's going to be a replacement for a notebook. You really have to come up with a list of what do you do with this? What do you need a mobile thing for? And will this or will this not deal with that? And even to the cost thing, I think that there's an argument to be made where you're talking about like a MacBook Pro that's going to cost you at least $2,000. If you think about it as I'm going to spend that $2,000 on computational solutions, maybe for a lot of people, a better solution is going to be I'm going to spend a little less than $1,000 on a Mac Mini, and I'm going to spend $1,000 on an iPad. So I will have a real computer, quote unquote, when I get home. But for field work, I will have this nice, nifty, high-powered tablet that weighs a lot less and has a lot less problems to deal with than a notebook. So you really have to skin the onion to find the answer to that, I think.
And I find myself going home. I don't take my computer home anymore. Like I don't, you know, I take my iPad home. so I, you know, because if I'm going to wake up in the morning and or at night and I'm thinking about stuff, you know, the iPad is, you know, just it's kind of a thought process. But I, you know, I'm sketching or I'm surfing around or thinking about stuff or, you know, that type of thing. And you know, it is, and I feel like part of me feels like we're just old when we think we can't use the iPad. My daughter
was Steven Sinofsky's contention was that it's just a generational thing, but I disagree.
My daughter is in the middle of a 30-page. She's 9 years old. She's written 30 pages of a story. She won't show me until she's done. But
yeah, but that's like saying because kids like McDonald's, you know, it's good enough for them. I just think they don't have an experience of a real work environment. I think the reason there's disagreement on this is for some people, it depends what you're trying to do. This is a great article by Austin Mann, who's a photographer. For some people, if what you are is a photographer and Lightroom does what you want it to do and you can import RAW, which you can, he says this is perfect. This is for me as an artist, this is exactly what I need. This is the best way for me to work. And absolutely true. But there are plenty of things you can do with a computer that the iPad requires either a struggle or can't do at all. It's mostly struggle. It's mostly workarounds. And that's why I think, yeah, a 10-year-old can write a report on it. But until the 10-year-old really starts to understand there's multitasking and the ability to have a web browser underneath your word processor and you can go back and forth, there is a better way to work. And it is a bit of a struggle right now, given the way iOS works, to get a job done on. And maybe we'll always be that way. I think for now, my conception is the iPad is an adjunct to a real computer for a few tasks. Now, notice, Alex, you still have a real computer at work. For a few tasks, it does well. But at the price of a real laptop, I mean, it's expensive.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's enough.
I think there's a real, like, Apple announced the iPad Pro and the MacBook Air at the same event. And I think that's not accidental. I think that graph they showed where they showed iPad sales compared to laptop sales, a lot of people said, oh, that proves it should be a laptop alternative. But I think what Apple was saying there is, like, look how many people they eschew laptops, but they really want an iPad. And for a lot of people, laptops are still inaccessible. Like they're super smart people too. They're just inaccessible, confusing, alienating computer boxes that they never had a rapport with. An iPad is something different. It's because they can touch it and interact with it, and it's direct. And it's not a replacement, but it's an alternative. And for their workloads, you're exactly right. Like they do writing and they do browsing and they do a bunch of things that they would never need Mac hardware for, and that's fine. And there's people in the middle who like really want iPad hardware, but really want it to be more Mac-like. And I think a few things like having File Picker work the same as Photo Picker, having some sort of external capacitive, because like you're typing on that keyboard, you have to still reach up and touch the screen, which is as annoying as not being able to touch the screen on the Mac. And there's like three or four things that I think if Apple just that use already existing technology, like they already have Focus UI in Apple TV, which is iOS, which lets you pick things on the screen with external input. Like if all those pieces come together, hopefully in iOS 13, a lot of those walls will crumble. And you'll still need I'll still need a Mac for Final Cut Pro. Developers will still need a Mac for Xcode for a while. But a lot of the other sort of small
Xcode development. I've been thinking about this. You could put obviously Apple could put Xcode on an iPad. But it would not be a good environment because you couldn't have your emulator running at this. I mean, it would not be an ideal environment. You look at developers, they have giant screens and they have multiple screens because they want to be able to see their code. They want to be able to see a lot of it. They want to be able to see the output of it. They want to have a web browser running. There's just a lot of things you want to do that
maybe
an iPad
like Diet Xcode. Like remember Diet Coda?
There's Pythonista. There are some very good, there's Swifty, there's some very good programming environments for the iPad, but they're really not, again, it's a struggle. It's not the ideal.
And you can't take your apps with you. And I think Photoshop will be, because it's also important to remember that iPads are RAM constrained compared to Macs, massively RAM constrained compared to Macs. But Photoshop has found a way to let you sort of take your Photoshop with you using a subset of really important tools. And I think, you know, developers would love the ability. It's not full on Xcode, but it's I can take my apps with me and work on the beach for a while and hit that button and have it build back.
I would say in almost
Mac
every case, the assumption that Adobe and others are making is you will also have a desktop.
Yeah, and I think for most people buying them, I think they're most of them do have a desktop, and I also think though that there's we'll see what happens with the programming interfaces and so on, or when we talk about Xcode, I think there's a real gap between shortcuts and Swift, and I think that gap someday I think Apple's going to fill with a nodal programming interface, and that's where an iPad becomes really useful, where it's not as powerful as Swift, but it isn't as limited as shortcuts.
Yeah, but I don't know any professional programmer that uses a nodal interface. It's great for learning.
It's not about professional programmers using it. It's about people being able to build something more complex than what they can do with shortcuts. Where they don't want to write code, like with Pixel Conduit that we had, what we did, you could build very, very complex composites. But there was also just nodes that were, you can add code here. You just add Java into this. Like you can say, take your inputs and then you can just write whatever you want. So there's this bridge, because what happens is I think that, shortcuts is great. I mean, it's amazing. But there are things that are complex that I think people would use on an everyday basis if they had a nodal programming interface where they could just say, I want to take these inputs and I want to go do this and I want to, I can build a little interface and I can put it together and it's done, really in a clean way. You have people kind of using the idea of programming every day. Now, what's going to happen is that's where kids start to just jump into it. Where kids get stopped is all the text, and so they start getting to the fact that they can build all this stuff and they don't need to have all this code. And then, but what happens is the ones that really get into it are going to feel limited by the nodal interface and want to have they're just going to want to have nodes that they can add, code to. But the next step will be to have, go to Swift, and I think Swift is the future. I think that, Apple's not going to keep on over a long period of time, keep on investing in anything else.
So is it fair to say that the iPad is one of two things? Either a standalone device for somebody whose needs are few. They want to watch Netflix, do a crossword puzzle, browse the web, maybe do some banking and email. Or your kids who want to, watch Phineas and Ferb. And the other person is adjunct, it's an accessory to a full-size computer. I mean, I see as a professional photographer, you'd want Lightroom, Photoshop, whatever tools you have on your desktop, but it's nice that it hooks up to Lightroom CC. On the iPad.
Mm-hmm. I think it lets you be both. I think, for a bunch of people who never bought computers or never liked computers or never used them, it is all the computer that they need. Like, I know I've used this example before, but I got my mom an iMac. She barely used it. I got her an iPad. Now she has two of them. She alternates between when the power runs out on one of them. And she calls it a computer, and it's the best computer she ever had.
Shouldn't she buy a $329 iPad, not the iPad Pro? That's
she might. She might.
This is my problem. Who is this iPad Pro for, really?
They didn't have that back. Like, they didn't have all the tools and all the things. And some people just want to run Lightroom. They don't need a whole computer for it. That's all they want to do. It's an Austin Mann type. There's a bunch of small niches. They're not the Steve Jobs niches anymore that he outlined in the beginning, but they're small. But on the other end, having an iPad Pro might be all you need to go mobile. And then instead of getting a MacBook Pro, you have your iMac at the desk. And because I think Gruber said this well a long time ago, because the iPad is so light, it lets the Mac get really heavy.
Oh, that's a good line. I like that. Yeah.
No, that's great. Well, and I think that also we're just starting to see what Apple does, or what not what Apple does, but what developers do with the USB-C. You know, when, you know, I can imagine, you know, having this screen and being able to plug it into my Blackmagic camera and be able to do paint and have scopes and all that other stuff that's there. And those kinds of things, I think, are going to be, you know, the kind of thing that we're going to see more of, you know, but because right now I have a whole bunch of external apparatuses that I have to go through to look at scopes while I'm looking through the video camera, while I'm doing other things. And that's just one example. And, you know, there are large sales workforces, not Salesforce, but well, actually Salesforce, but there are large workforces that are, you know, spending a lot of money on development, where they're giving insurance adjusters, salespeople, you know, all kinds of other folks, this is what we're issuing you. If you want a computer, you'll go buy it. We're giving you an iPad. You know, I think that the IBM partnership has probably done pretty well for Apple. And and there's a lot of dedicated things that are happening within a lot of these verticals. You know, and the iPad having a lot more power and a USB-C connection opens it up to a lot of those things that we haven't seen yet. So for now, maybe not. But for some of those, you know, using it embedded into a lot of other things, I think that there is a lot of application for Apple in the enterprise market for it.
Mm-hmm. I just think that the thing to keep in mind is that computing today is unrecognizable from what it was 10 years ago, or let alone 15 or 20 years ago. It's no longer the idea of here is my computer. Everything that we need a computer for is now spread across multiple devices. And so we don't have to take our Apple IIe with the monitor and the two disk drives with us when we go to college, or when we go to the store. We've got a pocket computer shaped like a phone for that. And we don't necessarily even need a computer, a computer when we go out just for a half hour jog. We've got a watch that will track us and let us contact people and let us listen to music when we got that. When we get home to our desks, we got the big hungalunga desktop with all the drives attached to it. And sometimes we just need a $300 tablet. So I think that the idea, we can't let ourselves be limited by the idea that computing is now the one device to rule them all. It really is nooks and crannies you keep filling with little devices as they become needed. I think that it does. It will. The hub of this experience will always be a rather conventional display with a keyboard and a screen and probably some sort of pointing device, because that really is the lingua franca of computing. It's the thing that will make give you most bang for the buck. But instead of spending all of your budget, let's say, on one big machine that does everything, I really think it's going to be more about, hey, well, here's a $300 Chromebook that will do all the stuff I need a conventional pointing device, screen, and keyboard for. But I'm also going to buy this really cool $800, $900 iPad Pro for when I want to do things that are kind of sophisticated and fast and unique, and on and on and on. So that's why, well, you know, it really isn't. It's about what hole do you have in your computing life? What will fill and spackle that hole perfectly? And it's more of a mosaic than a mural.
And I also think that we're spending more money on our electronics and less money on our cars and less money on other things. My kids, older and younger, have no interest in cars, in a lot of other things. I think a lot of people are spending more money on on those apparatuses, whether it's the laptop or the iPhone or the iPad, then they are interested in spending on other physical devices that we used to have. I mean, my kids don't ask me usually to go buy something for them at the toy store. They ask me for new apps. So, you know, like, you know, they want to buy a new app. They don't. Now, that's partially a function of the fact that they don't have an existence where they see a lot of ads. You know, like, so that might be part of it. But, you know, they just don't. They're not that interested in having like every little toy that was out there, you know. And I think that in the same way, I find myself spending more money on digital product than I, you know, in digital platforms than I do on physical things. And I think that we're going to see that trend continue.
So how much faster is the A12X Bionic in the new iPad Pro compared to the, what is it, an A10 in the $329 iPad? Is it enough of a difference?
I forget the number. Apple will tell you this too. The processors in the current generation iOS devices serve two main purposes. One is if you really do push the silicon, like if you really do run high-level AR apps or computational photography filters or machine learning, there's a bunch of stuff that can still peg these devices. Portrait mode used to peg those processors not a generation or so ago, right. But they're getting more and more overhead. But for the most part, for most people, they're not intended to be pure power now. They're intended to still run iOS 16 5 years from now, uh-huh. because they really do. It's that whole thing Lisa Jackson explained at the iPhone event. One of the best ways they've found not to fill landfills is to make devices last as long as possible, whether you keep them that long or you sell them or hand them down or something. So one of the principal jobs of A12, I keep calling it A1210 because damn Apple marketing, of A12X in this device is to allow you to run iOS 16 or 17 5 years from now and all the overhead that will come with that operating system inevitably in the future.
So it is the case there is at least a range of abilities and prices for iPads. And I think people might be tempted to get latest and greatest thing, but it's very expensive compared to the $329 iPad. And for many people, the first group, the people I talked about, surfers, emailers, Netflix watchers, a less expensive iPad is more than adequate.
Unless they really don't want to keep it for 5 years. I mean, if they want to keep it for 5 years and it's, you know, $1,000 and amortized as $200 a year, and it might be worth it for them. If they do want to buy more often and maybe getting the smaller iPad, it's $300. And if they decide they don't like it or something really attractive comes out next year or 2 years from now, then it's super easy to ditch that or give that away and get something else.
And an iPad Pro, particularly a tricked out iPad Pro with a pencil and a keyboard and a significant amount of storage, really is for somebody who has a professional use for it so that they can justify the price or enough money that they can say, I don't have to justify it, I'm going to buy it. And I think, honestly, most of those people will also have a computer of some kind, a desktop computer of some kind. And those people, if they need to, will start offloading work. You know, they go back and forth. Even, you know, what was his name, Austin Mann, the photographer who's singing the praises of the iPad, definitely has a desktop computer at some point with Lightroom in it that he's using.
They had him and his workflow at the event, and I think it was, I forget if it was a MacBook Pro or an iMac Pro and a Hasselblad camera and an iPad Pro.
Yeah. I mean, this is a good article, the new iPad Pro for photographers. He really talks about it. And the thing he says that's really interesting is it has changed his artistic flow. And in fact, the stuff he edits on the iPad, the photos he edits on the iPad actually are done differently, not better or worse, but differently than I'm keenly aware my images actually look different than they would if I edited on my Mac. Not better or worse, but different, he said. The tools have a major impact on the process, and I find myself expressing myself differently as an artist through iPad Pro. I think that that's really great. I think that that means it, you know, I think art does adjust to the tool you're using, and I bet you it's a more expressive and workflow for him that it's, and as I watch his videos, it's clearly he likes editing on the iPad Pro with Lightroom. And of course, as Lightroom gets better too on the iPad Pro, I expect you could do more, but right now, even Adobe is saying, and when you do that, it syncs back to your desktop. So, and where the raw file lives, and you can have then the raw file and you continue your workflow there. It's not the end point. It's the beginning point, the iPad. Is that all? I mean, I'm trying to find where this fits in people's lives.
I,
I think that it keeps on getting closer too. I mean, I think that, you know, I again, I'm not going to get into my workflow again about how I use Keynote.
It's frustrating though, Alex, right?
But
it's the power in this thing. This is an amazing, this is a computer from the future, but it's running software from the past.
It's a Porsche in Canada. It's got amazing, it's got a Lamborghini in Canada. Right. It's got amazing, you know, you love driving it, but then winter comes and you got to go back to the 4x4.
Yeah. Sorry, Alex. I didn't mean to interrupt you.
It's cutting edge.
Yeah.
But it doesn't do everything.
That's frustration.
For me, it's what's frustrating is just trying to figure out how to replace. I think a lot of these programs are still trying to figure out how to replace the mouse. You know, they're just things that you just go, well, I don't know how to, like, I complain about, you know, again, like some of the Pages and Keynote and, you know, all this other stuff. You get into it and it's just like this goofy thing that you have to do to get something done. You know, like I use OmniGraffle a lot. And I can't use it on the iPad. You know, like just what I do is too complex for it. But I understand the complexity of what it takes to make OmniGraffle to have that. I don't know how I would do that without being able to hold down a keyboard and use a mouse and everything else, because it's such a complex set of connections.
Right. What city is Alex in now? You've moved.
I moved. I've got the teleporter working great. You know, like you guys,
it's a wormhole.
I was waiting for the commercial break. I work for the commercial break because it does take a couple seconds and it looks like a little bit of a glitch.
Well, let me give you a commercial break. And then I want to talk about a couple of issues that we've discovered. One we discovered earlier today on iOS Today with the iPad Pro and audio. But first, a word from privacy. Ooh, I love privacy. I love it. I've been using privacy for some months. It is the only credit card I use on the internet. Privacy.com. I have a plugin that will give me a credit card number for anywhere I go. When I have that credit card number and use it, it locks to that merchant. So it cannot be used anywhere else. You don't use the same password everywhere. Why use the same credit card number everywhere when you shop online? I get a brand new virtual Visa card number for every purchase I make. Plus, I can establish limits. I could say it could be used once and once only, or I could say it could be used as many times as you want, but there's a limit on the amount each charge could be or the amount each month can spend or each year can spend. You can freeze and unfreeze cards. It's another reason to use it for subscriptions. I don't have to worry about figuring out which subscriptions I have. They all go through privacy.com. And when I'm done with a subscription, I just freeze the card. It is so awesome. You never have to worry about being billed twice or upgraded without your consent. You don't have to worry about forgetting to cancel subscriptions or free trials. And you can earn up to 5% cash back. Refunds work even if the card is closed or paused. So it's PCI DSS compliant, same security standards as your bank. Now, I should let you know, it ties into your bank account. So it is not a credit card, it is a charge card. You pay for it immediately, so you're not going to run a balance. I think for me, that's good, too, because credit card interest rates are so high. You don't have to worry about with this. And with the cash back up to 5%, it pays for itself. You don't pay privacy. Privacy.com is 100% free to use. They make their money for the merchants, just like any other credit card. They will not sell your information. There are no hidden fees. It's so private. This is another feature I like. I don't have to use my real address when I use a credit card. I can make up any address, any zip code I want. They support two-factor authentication. Of course, I turn that on, as I do everywhere. You get full control of your data, so you have access to transaction data via webhook API. I don't even bother doing that. I just have them text me or mail me when the cards are used. I have a complete paper trail of every time the card's used. I love Privacy.com. Privacy.com has saved customers over $100 million in unwanted and unauthorized charges due to compromised cards or hidden fees or forgotten subscriptions. It's a no-brainer. A unique credit card for every merchant, for every transaction if you want. So there's no threat. Privacy.com/MacBreak. You'll get $5 off your first purchase. Just a little thank you for using that special URL, privacy.com/MacBreak. I don't know how else to tell you about this except just set up an account and try it. It'll cost you nothing. You can use the app on iOS. You can use the app on the desktop. And you could also, I just use the web plugin. Makes it very easy for me.
and it is really awesome. Privacy.com/MacBreak. We thank them for their support. So I on iOS today, my mom was on the show. We like to do that every year for the holidays, get mom on the show. And she uses FaceTime. She's not a Skyper. She has an iPad Pro at home, the big 12.9-inch previous generation. And she loves to Skype on that. I Skype her, you know, fairly regularly just to say hi and all that stuff. And she uses headphones because she has the old iPad Pro with a headphone jack. We thought, well, she won't, by the way, let me send her a new iPhone because she doesn't want to lose the headphone jack. I understand that. But I thought, well, the good news about this USB-C is it does support audio out, analog audio out through the adapter that Apple sells. And I think that's a standard adapter. I used my the one that came with my Pixel C and that or Pixel phone, and that worked fine. Or it's we found out you can use a DAC on this. So it, we connected the USB to a USB-compatible digital-to-analog converter. We used the FIO, F-I-I-O. It works great. In fact, it gives you very good quality audio out. If you had a really good quality DAC, you'd be getting digital data, audio data when you're playing music back from the iPad Pro. The DAC could convert it to analog, plug in good headphones or a stereo system. That's a really an ideal way to do it. But FaceTime won't. FaceTime, no matter what we connected to the USB port, continue to come out of the speakers. Now, I imagine the AirPods, if you used a, you know, Bluetooth, would work fine, I hope. Didn't try that. We were able to AirPlay it and get the audio out that way. Is that a, that's got to be a bug. Nobody's ever told me about this before, but that's
yeah, no, that sounds totally like a bug. That should just work with headphones.
Yeah. So that's something to be aware of, and I guess I'll file. Can an individual file a bug with Apple?
Yeah, if you have a developer account, you can go to bugreporter.apple.com. Yeah, okay. Just file that in there.
Oh, by the way, Tolly said, I signed up for privacy, connected to my bank account, enabled two-factor while you were doing the ad.
Oh, that's awesome.
That's how it really is that easy. Sorry, I didn't mean to go back in the ad. All right, problem number two, and I think that I'm not alone in this. Lisa yesterday texted me, hey, Apple just had me change my iCloud password.
Yeah.
And so my immediate response to her was, are you sure it was Apple? It wasn't, you didn't, because I've been getting phone calls. This is Apple. Actually, they were robocalls. This is Apple Computer. This is Olivia from Apple Computer. Your iCloud account has been hacked. I ignored that because Apple does not do robocalls to my knowledge.
No.
But this was through, she said, no, it was on my device. And then it happened to me this morning. My iPhone suddenly says, oh, you need to re-log into iCloud. And I get that once in a while. So I did it and it said, nope, you need to change your password now. Your Apple ID is locked. You need to change your password. And now it turns out it's not just me and Lisa. According to 9to5Mac, others are experiencing this. Do we know what's going on?
I've actually had that happen to me, but it was a couple weeks ago.
I get it all the time because I'm always signing up new Apple devices, and I trip the velocity indicator.
So it was because we installed new Apple devices.
No, I think enough people are doing it now. And like, I don't want to speculate because the worst thing to do in a situation is to speculate. But like, for example, things that could cause this is, you know, a database gets hacked from a different company, like the famous Home Depot one. And people suddenly go out and try all those passwords on every other account they could find. And there's just a massive amount of password attacks coming in, and it trips a bunch of stuff. A lot of this uses AI. A lot of it uses machine learning. And one of the things about machine learning is that it's infectious, and it can do all sorts of strange things, like change your keyboard character to an A in a box when you're not paying attention. And again, I'm not saying that's what this is, but I'm saying there's a bunch of things that could happen that could cause a large number of iCloud accounts to lock. Because it looks like, again, it looks like a non-trivial amount of accounts. So my guess is that Apple will eventually say, we had such and such a thing happen, and it affected a quote-unquote small percentage of our customers, and we've done X, Y, Z.
I don't know what triggers a GDPR report, but GDPR requires within 72 hours, if there's been a breach, you have to report it. So if there was
it may not be a breach. It could just be like a bunch of hackers trying
something odd happened.
Yeah.
And it may not be an Apple breach either.
Right. Apple errs on the side of security and makes you change your password.
And there's various levels because not everybody got the same level. Some people just had to enter their password to make – and that happens every once in a while because the credentials get thrown out. So some people just had to enter their password. Others, you know, with two-factor. Others had to prove that it was their device by getting a code sent to another device. And yet others had to create a new password, which is the most annoying. I've had to do that several times now, which is the most annoying thing because then you have – if you have more than one Apple device, God help you, you're in your – it's a day-long activity and fixing them all and updating them all.
Yeah, I'm going to need to now lock in. What I did is I just made it monkey123 so it'd be easy to log in on all of these devices instead of that long, strong password I have to use LastPass for every time. So that's going to save me some time from now on. But it means I have – I'm joking. It is. It's a pain in the butt. I have many, as you know, I have a few Apple devices and all.
You got to be careful. I don't know if you saw it, but a guy on Twitter tweeted a picture about a wallet for e-currency and people on Twitter very quickly showed him 11 of the 12 words that guarded his wallet just by using Photoshop to increase the contrast on the inside of the image that he tweeted. Never joke about anything because they'll find a way.
I did think it might be just because Lisa and I both set up new MacBook Airs and new iPads in the last couple of days. And, of course, new iPhones last month. And that maybe all those new devices. But that's got to be, this time of year, pretty common in Apple land.
Yeah. So, again, that can be a trigger. But I think there's way too many people for that to be the trigger case for all of them. Yeah. Especially now that it's like a week after launch.
Right. 9to5 says we haven't quite worked out the pattern or the cause, but we've received many reports of users waking up to find their Apple ID has been locked. Now, some of them, it looks like, and there's different ways to reactivate. Some actually have to answer security questions. I hope to God they don't have me answer security questions. that's the worst. I don't know what my fifth grade teacher's name was.
Well, the problem is that I tend to not want to use the ones that... You know, you get into this thing where you think you're going to remember it and you don't want to use the obvious question, the obvious answers for some of those security questions, and then you don't give them and then you're just screwed. Yeah. You know, you can't figure it out.
Apple probably should step up and just say something, right?
Yeah.
Well, and the other problem is that with those security questions is that the name of the street that you used to live on as a kid, A, publicly available information, and B, it's the same information. So if you tell one website what was the name of your first pet or what was your name of your first college roommate, now you're trusting the security of that site to not be violated so that when your bank is asking that question, when other things that are important are asking that question, that's why I have to wait for it to scroll down and say, why don't I give you a question that will only – what was – when you were abducted and taken to Venus, which of your captors' 11 toes turned into a purple squad?
Yeah, I mean, security questions are bad. Provided questions are worse.
Yes.
The only real way to
hit.
Yeah.
We try to get the questions from you. Your porn star name is the street you grew up on and your first pet.
Yeah.
And then suddenly that company has both.
The only reasonable way to do this is in LastPass, generate a basically treat it as additional passwords. Yeah. You have to store the question and your response in LastPass. And use LastPass to generate random responses. It's the only reasonable way to handle this. But that does not work in all cases. I've literally seen, I can't remember what it was, some big company that provided drop-down for questions and then a drop-down for answers. Your favorite color is this. You couldn't put an arbitrary answer in that. It infuriated me.
Yeah.
Just horrible. This security questions are... I'm surprised Apple uses them, but I guess it's the only way you can do this with normal people, but it's just a bad idea. Please don't.
Yeah.
That's Apple has responded to the reports that some iPhone 10 screens are having some sort of touch disease. Mark Gurman in Bloomberg says Apple says iPhone 10 units have faulty touch screens. Also, some 13-inch MacBook Pros are having problems. You'll know. There's a site where you go for Apple to enter your Apple serial number, right?
Apple put up support articles. So if you at support.apple.com, it doesn't matter which version of the iPhone X. If you have that problem, it affects all versions from the minute they started selling them to when they end of life them in September. So if you have an iPhone X and either it's not properly registering touch or it's registering spurious touches, like something happens and you never touch the screen, you can take it in and Apple will fix it. And if you already paid to have it fixed, they'll reimburse you. The 13-inch MacBook Pro with no touch bar is different. That's not a replacement program. It's a service program. So if you have an error with the SSD, which can be either corruption or failure of the SSD, if you put in your serial number, it will tell you if you have an affected model. And then if you do, you can take it in again and have the SSD replaced. It's not every one of them, but you can enter in your serial number and they'll tell you if it's you.
So people should go to support.apple.com.
Yeah.
And let's get that fixed.
Yes.
At least you know it's not in your imagination. You can take this article and show it to your friends, your spouse, your parents. Say, no, you see, I didn't. I was just
at the bottom.
And once again, I mean, a lot of people get super frustrated and they're like, Apple's not listening to me. But it's a big company. When they get reports of problems, it hits a system and a certain number reported. It triggers one of these programs, and a lot of it is very programmatic.
Go to support.apple.com, scroll down to the bottom. They have an exchange and repair extension programs. And actually, it turns out to be there's a dozen of them here. There's a number of different problems. So it's probably a good idea once in a while to check that and see if.
And they'll email you. If they know that you're on the list, they'll typically email you. So you can also just check your junk and see if it's in there.
Yeah, that's the problem, right? It's all in the junk mail. Let's see the, what was, it was Singles Day, 11/11 Sunday. And, we talked up all about how Alibaba sold $1 billion in the first 85 seconds. They had a record breaking $30 billion in sales, $30.8 billion in sales on 11/11/11. Amazing. But Apple did okay as well. In fact, Apple's iPhone beat both Huawei and Xiaomi, the two biggest cell phone companies in China, on 11/11. During the Alibaba Singles Day event, iPhone sales led other smartphone brands on Alibaba. So that's, I guess, good news. Global sales, of course, starting to flatten in the West, but you got a whole new country to sell stuff to in China. Stan Lee passed away.
Yeah.
And I know you comic book fans are sad, although he was 95. He had a good long life.
Excelsior, Stan.
Excelsior. And App Store is honoring him. I don't know. I hope I'm not stealing anybody's pick. But they have a remembering Stan Lee section in the App Store, where they have a number of, there's a story and a tribute to him, so that's nice. Inside the story, a collection of 10 apps in three groups: read and draw, play the games, act and learn. 8 comic book reader apps. I didn't know there were so many. I think we've talked about a number of them.
Nerds are particular about their comic book reader apps. Everybody it's sees true. A problem and everybody wants to fix it.
So true.
I do have a really awesome Stan Lee story.
Okay, let's hear it.
Okay, so it's 1999. It's the one and only time I've ever been to the San Diego Comic-Con, and I'm staying like at the very, very top floor of the Marriott, which is like right next door to the convention center. It's like part of the convention center, and so I hit the button, go downstairs. I'm on like the 88th floor, whatever. And the elevator stops at the 86th floor, and Stan Lee gets on.
Nice.
And I am alone in an elevator with Stan Lee. And I'm silent until like the 78th, the 76th floor. And at which point I turn to him and say, well, obviously I'm going to say thank you for all the wonderful work you've been doing. You've done for your entire career. And he couldn't be there. Oh, well, thank you very much. Aren't you nice? And then he noticed that I had a press badge. He said, oh, you remember the press? Or who do you write for? And I say, well, I've worked for the Chicago Sun-Times, but I've been lately I've been doing a lot of features for Playboy magazine. Oh, Playboy, Hugh Hefner was a very, very big fan of cartoonists and comics. And we start talking about like cartoonists in the 60s and 70s. And they start asking me, what's the freelance market like now? Is it good to be freelancer these days? And I find myself now talking to Stan Lee about, you know, being not a freelance journalist in a collapsing market, but a freelance journalist in a thriving market. And I'm watching, no one is getting on the elevator. I'm alone on an elevator. And then we finally get to the first floor and we're ending our conversation. And then there are times when like your brain wants to be the least helpful part of your entire body. And fortunately, my brain knew that if it screwed me up here, I was going to throttle it. And so it gave me the presence of mind to say, I think there's some people meeting him in the lobby, say, well, Stan, thank you so much. It was really, really a great thrill. Hope you have a great rest of the show. Instead of saying, hey, Stan, so where are we going next? Let's keep talking. And so
you want to go to dinner? Come over exactly. to my house.
And I interviewed him once or twice like after that. But that was like he was the nicest guy. Again, being trapped in an elevator with a comic book fan at Comic-Con. Wow. And he could not have been the nicest, most generous person ever. I got a very, very Stan moment.
That is a lot to be said for that. That is awesome. Yes. Stanley, he is at the 1975 Comic-Con.
Looks like Downey.
That is a hell of a publicity still. I really would like that that picture.
he was 1970-ing at a 1979 level, even back then.
Oh, he was a high, very, very high level. Do you want to buy a Johnny Ive diamond ring?
What?
It's entirely diamond. There's no.
And when they say it's a diamond ring, they mean it's a diamond ring.
It's a ring made out of diamond, baby.
So absolutely all glass, no bezel, literally.
Yes. Sotheby's said the ring was created for the Red Auction, so they're raising money for fighting HIV/AIDS in Africa. Don't know what it'll cost. It was created by the Diamond Foundry, a certified carbon. Yeah, it's a little weird to sell diamonds to benefit Africa, but this is a certified carbon neutral diamond producer.
Well, yeah, the point is that it is a diamond. I mean, I think that this is actually the point. Yeah. Is that it is a diamond that is not made in Africa. So it's benefiting Africa, but it's a synthetic diamond. And I think that one of the things that a lot of folks are trying to do with this is there's a fight that's going on between De Beers and the synthetic creators. De Beers is really trying to run a thing that if it's not pulled out of the ground, it's not real. Right. You know, and essentially synthetic diamonds are identical to what's coming out of the ground, and that's De Beers' problem. And so De Beers runs a lot of campaigns about it, even though they're starting to invest in synthetic because they're they don't want to be left out. But on the synthetic side, there's a lot of push to sell diamonds to people like me that work and have done a lot of work in Africa and won't buy a diamond. You know, my wife has a yellow sapphire instead of a diamond because I wouldn't buy one. So the issue is that I think that there's a large market, and I think they see that. So this is a huge in addition to raising a lot of money for Africa, it's a marketing push to say we should, and I'm sure that Bono is behind this kind of marketing push, and so it's probably Johnny Ive, we should start really considering synthetic diamonds the right way to go as opposed to pulling them out of the ground.
Good. A mere $150,000 to $250,000. But it's for a good cause.
Mm. Yes.
Yeah. What are the chances that thing isn't going to break into like 14 different pieces as soon as you just like flex your fingers?
I have a feeling.
It's not made by Banksy. Come on.
You buy another one, Andy. Fine. Yeah.
I think that goes into a little box and it sits on somebody's desk or it sits on somebody's wall. I don't think that anyone's going to wear it.
Diamonds are pretty hard, aren't they?
They're brittle. They're brittle, yes. Right? They're hard for scratch purposes. They're not hard for accidentally tap your tack your hand against the desk while you're making a point hard.
You wear it inside out and become a cat burglar.
And that kind of shape is not going to be great for something that's brittle. So it's going to be a great thing to talk to your friends about and put on your put somewhere in it, but it wouldn't be great to wear it every day.
Well, that was my pick of the week. So how many Alex's is that? Quite a few. Quite a few. Let's take a little break, and then we will get back with your picks of the week, my friends. But first, let's talk about belts. I need a good stiff belt. Not that kind of belt. I'm talking about slide belts by Brig Taylor. High-quality, comfortable ratchet belts. You know, there's a flaw in the whole concept of a belt. A piece of leather you put around your waist with a few holes, and if your belly doesn't match those holes, well, tough. You're either going to, your pants are going to fall down, or you're going to be uncomfortable. Slide belt uses a patented ratchet mechanism that gives you 32 precise adjustment options on every slide belt. And by the way, some of the most beautiful buckles you've ever seen. Slide belts, these are the holiday gift. Not just for guys, they have slide belts for ladies too. Notice I got the Twit buckle on here. These belts can be interchangeable, so it's kind of like Apple Watch bands. You have different materials, and they have all kinds. They have everything from full grain and top grain leather straps to high quality canvas, animal friendly vegan straps. Once you get the strap, you put the buckle on. You can trim the strap to get it close to your waist size. But then, you know, this is what Lisa hears every morning as I put on my slide belt. She hears the ratchet. And then, I have to say, I commend them for this. As the day goes by and my belly expands with meals, I can slowly ratchet it out without making any noise. So you can easily expand it surreptitiously. And your pants will no longer fall down. Your belt will fit perfectly. And by the way, looks dynamite. It is such an improvement to the traditional belt. You can remove the buckle, mix and match with other straps for ultimate customization and versatility. It's great for casual wear around the house, dress at the office, or wear it to a holiday party because they have great colors. And it's a great travel belt because it's easy to slip on and off. But if you are traveling, my suggestion is you not wear this one. The Survival Belt by Slide Belt. This probably is not TSA approved. This belt buckle, however, is going to be awesome for the next time you're stuck in the wilderness because it has a built-in knife, a bottle opener, flashlight, and fire starter. You're set. It's and it's all kind of secretly hidden away inside your Slide Belt utility buckle. I always think this would be a great gift, whether you've got a bunch of groomsmen to give a gift to. You could, by the way, you can have these monogrammed with the names of the bride and groom if you want, or a holiday gift for the man in your life or the woman in your life. Lisa probably wants one too, I think. Coming soon, Renee, watch out. Slide belt watches with swappable watch bands.
So good.
And when you go to slidebelts.com/twit, click on the gift set tab. You can see some great gift sets, but just a note that those sets, because they're already discounted, don't qualify for our special offer. But everything else on the site, 20% off when you use the offer code TWIT. Look, there's a guy whittling a sharp stick with his belt buckle. Now I ask you, how much would you pay? Slidebelts.com/TWIT. With the offer code TWIT, you'll pay 20% less. That's how much. And again, there's some great discounts in the gift section. I love my slide belts. You will too. Slidebelts.com/twit. Stacey Higginbotham was doing the slide belts ad. She said, oh, that's all Andrew wears. Her husband's a slide belts guy. I didn't even know that. Once you use them, they're so comfortable. You just never. And I just kind of, this to me, this is the last thing I do as I'm getting dressed. I'm cinched in and ready to go. All right. Time for our picks of the week. Andy, I see you have a couple. Let's go. Let's do it, man.
I just got one of the coolest phone apps that I've ever seen. It's called the RPM app. It's an app for testing the speed and accuracy of your turntable. You run it on your iPhone.
Finally.
Then you put your iPhone on top of the turntable. And as it rotates, it uses the accelerometer to measure the speed and the wow and flutter.
Oh, my God.
And I linked to a YouTube video from one of my favorite YouTubers, Techmoan, who talks about vintage audio stuff. That's where I keep seeing it from, and it's just the coolest thing ever. One of the reasons why it's so cool is that the display stays constant, so you can keep reading it.
Oh my god, it's rotating! Oh my god, that's hysterical.
So it has a little, So it has like a little circular display in the middle of it. He's probably showing something. Yeah, there you go. So it will not only give you the speed, but also like the vibration.
It ain't 33 and a third. We got to fix that turntable.
Yes.
That's awesome.
And like I said, if I only own one kind of novelty turntable, but I had to get the app because I just wanted to put the phone on the turntable and watch it rotate around while the display stays like level so I could read it. I suppose if you are an audiophile or if you like to treat yourself, I thought I could hear a 0.02% I'm glad I was right there. That now I know I was absolutely right there. Yeah. It's just pretty damn cool.
That's hysterical. RPMapp.info. RPMapp.info. Very nice. Renee, your pick of the week.
So my pick, I apologize in advance. I'm going to pick Thrifter because they're going to do their Black Friday stuff.
Yes.
But I have to say in advance that Thrifter is owned by the same company that owns. They're not like the same network, but the same parent
it's
company.
Mobile Nations.
Owns Thrifter. Yeah. Well, I don't think it's Mobile Nations. I think it's the company that owns Mobile Nations also owns Thrifter, but I really never pay attention to that stuff.
I didn't even know there was a company that owns Mobile Nations.
All the money goes through Ireland, doesn't it?
No. Somewhere in the U.S., which I don't know if it's scarier or better.
The less you know, the less you can testify to. Exactly. We're not going to press you on this point.
No, but I believe it's the same company that owns Mobile Nations, owns Thrifter. But anyway, they're gearing up to do another one of their 24/7 Black Friday things where they look at every deal, they vet them, they make sure they're actually the price is actually good. It's not just, you know, they raised it before, now they're lowering it again, and they're going to do up to the minute. They're going to have Twitter notifications, web notifications, a newsletter with the best deals for 24 hours. And they're already talking about some because apparently Black Friday now starts in the beginning of October and runs until Christmas Day, and it's really like a month and a half Black something or other Oktoberfest.
It's like I don't know, but it's new Christmas. They're moving Christmas up. Yeah,
it's crazy, and they've already got like there's deals on iTunes cards. I don't know when they start, but there'll be like iTunes cards, $50 cards for $40. And Dan DeSilva, who runs Thrifter, gave me a bunch of tips. Like you get those cards and you use that to get your Netflix subscription or to get your apps or something. And then because those are already discounted for the holidays. So it's like double discounts. Walmart is doing $300 cards on iPhone XR and XS. And because Walmart sells everything, that's basically like getting money back on what. Anyways, there's a whole bunch of them and they're always changing. But if you go to thrifter.com, they will always have up-to-the-minute stuff on all the Black Friday things. And I always say, don't buy things you don't need. Like, don't use this as a way to spend more money than you have to. But make your list. Know what you want to buy, both for yourself and for others. And then find deals on those things. And that way you're actually saving money and not just spending a bunch of money on things that you wouldn't otherwise buy.
Yes.
100%.
Or get an iPad Pro.
Yeah, I mean, if it's on discount, like if you and can find one that gives you money back.
Yeah, honestly, it seems a shame to talk about the cost of these devices when you know there'll be some deals out there, or at least some ways to get better deals on them.
Someone's going to want something from you bad enough they'll give you a break on the cost
of the
device.
Go. There you go. Alex Lindsay, your pick of the week, my friend.
So mine is not very expensive.
Oh, good. He's out at the Indian reservation now, the wigwams. Exactly.
So I walked into there are times when I, you know, it's the middle of the day and I just feel like a McDonald's hamburger, just the hamburger. Like I don't want it. I don't want anything else.
No,
I don't want
any more double cheese, man. It's two hamburgers.
Oh no, I don't want more. I just want you know, there's something about it. I probably go to McDonald's, you know, once a month or so for this one little thing. I just want a hamburger, maybe every quarter or something.
We call them regulars.
Yeah, and that's so I walked in. It was a long line, and then I saw this. I saw the app, you know, the little thing, and the little mobile section. So I checked it out. I was like, the app is really good. So you know, this is the thing that I think that a lot of companies
McDonald's
are.
App.
Oh my gosh, it's really good. It's like really well done.
Your
like,
pick of the week is the Mickey D's app.
So So here's the thing, is for the people who are listening, it's not necessarily that you should go to McDonald's. You should look at the design of how they put this app together.
Okay.
So it is, you know, it is just the problem is that point of sale for a lot of these companies, you know, for a lot of these companies is not done very well. You know, it's cumbersome, it's a pain in the neck, you don't get the information you want. You either have to customize too much or not enough. And so it's not so much that everyone should go out and use McDonald's. The big thing is that I just wish that designers would look at apps that were well thought out and user oriented when it comes to buying the stuff, where we're going to minimize the amount of pain it takes to, you know, to actually order something and to know what you're ordering and so on and so forth. It tells you exactly where your nearest McDonald's is. It's going to have it ready for you when you walk in, like, and it just figures all of that stuff out, and it's just done. It's done really well and effortlessly. So it's not a pick that, again, that everyone should go out and get McDonald's. It's a free pick. So, you know, I can, you know, but the point is that what I've been looking at a lot around point of sale is, you know, I've been downloading a lot of people's restaurant apps, you know, and I think it makes a huge difference for a lot of retailers and restaurants to figure out, for brick and mortar to figure out how to make it easy for people to buy. I get a Greek salad. There's a place called in DC called GRK Fresh. I think it's just in New York and DC. It's like this Greek thing. And I get a Greek salad every day. Now, partially it's a really good kale salad. But I can also order it. I can order it in less than 60 seconds on my computer and then walk in and pick it up, you know, and the thing is that you know, that's half of the puzzle. The other half is that it's a really good salad. But the point is that ease of point of, you know, and not trying to put a bunch of marketing on top of it, and not, you know, like the number of clicks is super important when it comes to figuring out how to use these apps. And I think that a lot of companies feel like they're falling down, you know, on the fact that they make it too hard to order stuff from them. And I think that brick and mortar would do a lot better if they could figure out how to make that super seamless and super easy. And I think that McDonald's has done a pretty good job.
Awesome. So that's my, I'm loving it, as they say.
Can I log one small point of rebuttal?
Yep.
Now not only do they have the app, but they also have like the kiosk inside the store, so you don't have to actually interact with a counter person. Oh yeah.
Kiosk. Okay.
This is the double whammy that disappoints me about the kiosk.
How do I not know about this?
I went into one and I didn't know where it was. It's completely changed.
You don't drive on turnpikes long enough. That's the issue.
Yeah. I worked at McDonald's all through high school.
Ours are all Mac Cafe now. We don't have McDonald's anymore.
I'm deeply addicted to a McDonald's food, but I guess because of that, I try to not go anywhere near it. And you've triggering. I'm just saying, trigger warning. Okay, I'm just saying.
You don't go into McDonald's because you want to peruse the daily menu, ask what the specials are.
Yeah.
Because once a month, I want like either a Big Mac value meal or a quarter pound with cheese value meal. Once a month, I want it. It's really, really tasty.
I know.
Okay. And so you would think that like the value meals are like would be like a top level selection. But not only that, but there is no menu option for value meals. What you have to do is tap add a sandwich, add Big Mac, and then ask for a value meal. But the thing is, again, I don't go to McDonald's enough that I've got this down to muscle memory yet. I don't know where to find value meal. And as soon as God bless these people. They're very, very well trained. They only want to be helpful, but they see someone above the age of 15 years old using a touchscreen device and being confused for a moment. And then suddenly I'm Uncle, do you need some help using the kiosk? Here, let's walk you through this. Like, I know how to use this. I know how to use tap and pay. I just want to know where the value meal is. Don't condescend.
Get away from me, kid.
Don't be condescending to me.
I'm your elder. Our generation won World War II for you. Get away from me.
You realize that I got my email through FidoNet, okay? So, yes, I'm old, but I'm also very technologically hip.
Now I'm going to go to McDonald's right now. I'm going to McDonald's.
Yeah, the kiosk. Kiosk is useless. Like, I used it and I'm like, I'm never going to use this again. So it was that their kiosk was a complete fail. So it was obviously two separate teams that put this together.
Well, I'm sure trying to figure out is, can we do a McDonald's without humans?
You know, so that they've got one in Phoenix that runs on two people. I understand that is so that and the people get paid more because all they do is manage the machines. But the so far, at least the reports are, is that they have, you know, they're adding a lot. What they're trying to do is add a lot more.
Thousand
people are now delivering.
1,000 stores every 3 months are getting self-order kiosks.
I think that they're supposed to try to get, but they still have the regular ones there. And again, the kiosks are so bad, I don't know why anyone would use them. But the mobile is really good. Like, I don't know if I'd ever go to McDonald's without ordering ahead of time now. Because, you know, you just...
So do you pick it up at the kiosk or...
There's a side area. It's kind of like Starbucks when you order, like, and the Starbucks one is like I don't order the Starbucks one because it's just mass chaos. You know, like Starbucks hadn't figured out how to, like, I still go and order because I actually want it to be hot, because I don't never know, like with Starbucks, you don't know whether you're going to show up and it's going to be not ready or you're going to show up and it's going to be cold. Like, there's no way to tell the time. And so it kind of defeats Starbucks, but, and it might be the same way with McDonald's, but after I did the first try, I was like, oh, I'm going to just use this all the time. I'm not going to go in and stand in line and, you know, do all
that
stuff.
Wouldn't it be really cool if McDonald's had, like, healthy, good food and then all this stuff?
They do, but they sell it alongside the Big Mac value meal with the fries.
It tastes so good.
That once a month, so good. I really, really kind of got to have.
I think, by the way, the secret to McDonald's.
I can buy a bag salad at home for $3 and put olive
oil on it. My godson started ordering a meatless Big Mac, which I didn't know was a thing, but they basically give you a Big Mac without any patties in it.
Oh, yum. The secret to McDonald's, I believe, having worked there for many years, is they put sugar in absolutely everything.
And salt.
I mean, everything. Nope. No, there's salt, but the key indicative ingredient is sugar. And it's just got a lot of sugar. And
did you make the off-menu items, Leo? Like when you stuff the fillet of fish into the Big Mac and all
puppy
that?
Puppy patties, okay. whatever you needed. Grilled cheese, I know how to make that. I can do it all.
I didn't know people would order those. Apparently, there's a whole subculture.
I didn't
with
get fat
items.
Until I started working at McDonald's. I just want to say that's when my troubles began.
I'm glad that they used to have they would make a Big Mac only out of like quarter pounder components. So it'd be like the quarter pounder bun and the quarter pounder patties, but made like a Big Mac.
But with special sauce.
And I had that a couple of times when it was still on the menu, and I decided it's a good thing that this is not a regular meal item, because I can barely justify the Big Mac as it is.
You know, the only reason I don't still work at McDonald's is they gave me an offer at one point and then they looked at me when I said, no, I don't want to go to Hamburger U. I'm going to Yale. Thank you anyway. They said, we're not going to rehire you. You're not management material. We get the feeling you don't want to
limit your opportunities here.
Yeah.
Think of it as a window opening, not a door closing.
My pick of the week is from toolsandtoys.net. Their annual Christmas catalog is out. Lots of Apple stuff. And I want to point out that they donate 11% of their gross, 11% to App Camp for Girls, Operation Christmas Child, and St. Jude. So it's a really good thing. Let's go look at the Apple stuff. A lot of good places. A lot of good. For instance, here's Elevation Labs draft table iPad stand. Yeah. This is stuff here. I mean, don't you think you need 12 South's leather AirPods case? I think you do. Of course, the
Spygen wore that like Han Solo's blaster.
I know. Blaster. Doesn't that look cool? Oh, man. Yeah. Hanging off your belt. Those are my iPods. My AirPods. there's the pocket printer, the print pocket printer. This is a great way if you've got a geek in your life. I don't want to show Renee this. He might start crying. A $17 double tour leather band for the Apple Watch.
The Apple doesn't make one for the 44 millimeters,
really?
So I'm fine.
Oh.
Yeah. Right. They only make the single tour.
It's a copy of the $1,400 Hermes double tour. Nice audio, too. So, toolsandtoys.net, their annual 2018 Christmas catalog. They donate a good chunk to very good causes, but also they've handpicked some wonderful. This is the seventh year in a row they've been doing this. Wonderful stuff in all kinds of categories. Ladies and gentlemen, we conclude this McDonald's tribute episode. I think you deserve a break.
Kudos to Sean Blanc for doing the Tools and Toys stuff. It's so awesome.
You know about Tools and Toys. Yeah.
Yeah, Sean Blanc, awesome guy.
Yeah, I actually, this is the first time I'd seen it. And I was really blown away. I thought, they do a nice job of this. This is great. Probably a competitor, but I'm sorry, Renee.
No, the world is a big world, Leo, and I love all these things.
What can I say?
Like I said, Sean Blanc is awesome.
Right. There he is, editor-in-chief.
Yep.
Ladies and gentlemen, we have concluded Mac Break Weekly for this fine week. We will be back next Tuesday. We'll be on time next week, if I can manage it somehow. Even though I will be cooking for Thanksgiving the day before, because Thanksgiving's next week, right? We will be here probably around 11 a.m. Pacific. That'll be 2 p.m. Eastern Time, 1900 UTC. You can watch live at twit.tv/live. You can visit us in the chat room at irc.twit.tv. All the kids who are watching live are in there. Or you can get on-demand versions at our website, twit.tv/mbw. Watch or listen whenever you feel like it. You can also listen on your voice assistant. Just ask for Mac Break Weekly. Almost certainly it'll be able to play the most recent episode for you. But the best thing of all to do, make my holidays happy by subscribing in your favorite podcast application. Just search for Mac Break Weekly. Subscribe. And then you'll get it the minute it's available. Thank you, everybody. But now I must say it's time to get back to work. Break time is over. Bye-bye.